Because structure to study is, non-commutative geometry as defined by Alain Cohn. I want to look at what could be the possible justification for a modification of geometry, and whether non-commutative geometry is in the end a good somehow ansatz for physics. So, what is physics telling us about how we should think about quantum geometry instead of taking, this very a beautiful mathematical concept, which somehow came out of nowhere, or came out of the imagination invention of Alain Cohn here, and of course my background here is to think of geometry in the context of quantum gravity. So I want to understand what could be a geometrical concept. So what are the geometrical concepts that could encapsulate what quantum gravity is telling us? So of course. What we all know, there's a wide diversity today of geometrical description of the world, or and even more of models of quantum gravity, whether it's string theory, causal dynamic contributions, spin networks, non-commutative geometry. None of them are really, have any overlap with the others. But what they have one thing which is in common, which is that all of them claim and postulate some form of non-locality. Okay, so the one thing we know is that quantum gravity will involve some form of non-locality. And the question that somehow is the central question in my view in the field is what type of non-locality, And the problem is that as soon as you start to open the box of non-locality, go away from locality, it's a Pandora's box in the sense that there's many, many, many different possibilities, options, axioms you could take. One of them, and then you get confused, you might get non-unitary. But one of the options is this non-commutative geometry here. So why is it so complicated to think physics? To think, in fact, when I say think physics, it's just even to think in the context of non-locality. And it's that today our understanding of locality is built in everywhere, at every single. Yeah, I know, this is annoying. Why is it this thing's popping?
Did you mute it? Try that.
Sorry. It's annoying. I'm going to wake you up all the time. If I have the hockey stick, that would be nice. I'll try to point them. So it's built on the notion of locality of asymptotic states. When you talk about particle, one of the key properties of particle is that they are point-like. So things like points exist. So there's no notion of matter if there's no notion of point. Locality of interaction, the way things interact, and the way we organize interactions via locality. And an even more important concept, the concepts of locality, is the concept which is the main organizational concepts of all physics, which is the renormalization group concept. Why is it the main concept? It's because it's the concept behind, which is the concepts of separations of scale. If I do physics in this room, I do something microscopical, I don't have to know what happens at the other end of the universe. So this notion of separation of scale is really the strongest leftover of what locality is. And it's built in everywhere. Okay, so. Well, the question is why, should you think about non-locality? It's not a physicist audience here, so let me emphasize a bit more that 2 points, which are well known to physicists, is that at least the first one, quantum mechanics, we know it's non-local, in the sense that quantum mechanics. If you look at the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, it says that you cannot localize something in X. At fixed energy, if you have a fixed amount of energy as a resource, you cannot resolve space-time more than a fixed distance. Now, there's a deeper notion of non-locality, which is in entanglement. We know that quantum mechanics allow some form of correlation at large distance that cannot be explained in terms of local actions. Something which is even more important and less known is called Aronoff-Bohm non-locality, is that in the sets of quantum observable, there are certain quantum observable that exist, which Aronoff called modular observable. And this is how he discovered one of the most striking effects of quantum mechanics, which is Aronoff-Bohm phase and Aronoff-Bohm non-locality. The fact that interference phase are affected by potential of electromagnetic field, even if there is no classical force that can act anywhere on the system. And this is the non-locality of interferences. The non-locality of interference, as Aronoff understood, is because when you look at the quantum algebra, you look at the algebra of operator, there exist at the quantum level observables that have no classical analog. So the sets of observable you have at the quantum mechanical level are more than the sets of observable that you have classically. And these are exactly these observables, which you call modular observables, which you know allow you to witness the existence of interferences. Okay, so we're going to see that. And these observables are going to be a focus because in some sense they are the... Oh, I need to plug my computer. These observables are you know the essence of quantum mechanics, in the sense that if you take quantum mechanics and you factor out by all you can know about quantum mechanics from classical mechanics and its expansion, then all that's left over are these new phenomena, radically new phenomena that have absolutely no classical analog, and they have a leftover in terms of the operator algebra. This is this modular observables. Okay. So now, and I think that's kind of well known, except maybe the last point about modular observable, which is not appreciated enough. Now, the next thing is that if you take pure GR is also a fundamentally non-local theory. And maybe I should take some time here because you're not familiar with GR, and GR is the main theme of, so how do you think, you know, physics in terms of gravity? In terms of the interaction of gravity. And why is it that gravity is fundamentally non-local? So first, it's non-local because of gauge invariance. So you know, what is the gauge invariance? So what you may know about gauge invariance is you know, QED, electromagnetism, which means essentially if I put a charge here, you know, some electron, it's going to create flux lines of the field, okay? And in electromagnetism, there's a law that is called the Gauss's law, Gauss's law is essentially the essence, the expression of what gauge invariance is. What the Gauss's law tells you is that if we put a charge somewhere, it will necessarily create flux lines that cannot terminate on the charge. So if you put an observer which is far away, you know, it doesn't have to go near the charge. By measuring the correlation in the electromagnetic field, he can tell exactly what's inside. Okay, so there's some form of holographic nature of a gauge charge. Right? Gauge charges, essentially, gauge charges, you know, are holographic, which means that, in fact, you know, you can know the information about something which is far away from where you are just because of this gauge invariance. So now, it means that any observable in field theory which is gauge invariant needs to close off these lines, and therefore it cannot be local. There is no observable in a gauge theory that can be a non-local observable. So usually what you do is that maybe you put a charge here plus, put a charge here minus, and then you close the lines, and this is a quasi-local observable. Okay, and it means that, so usually what you use to create a local observable in physics is a screening. Okay, so if something fluctuates in the center of the sun, you don't feel it because it's screened by the other negative charge there. Now in gravity, gravity is a gauge theory. What is the gauge charge of, what are the gauge charge of gravity? The gauge charge of gravity are not scalars, they are energy and momenta. Okay, these are the charges of gravity. Okay, the charges of gravity, which is energy and momenta, because they are gauge charge, are delocalized, and this is the principle for, you know, this is the reason why gravity is fundamentally holographic. It means that you can have informations about energy and momenta of something extremely far away if you could decode the gravitational field.
You can see GIJ metric as a gauge field?
Yes, of course, GIJ is like A mu nu, yeah. Yeah, so here I'm talking about the charge, you know, E is promoted to, the charge is promoted to EP, and your A field, you know, A mu field is promoted to, you know, G mu nu if you want. Okay, and A couples to a current, which is the charge current, and G mu couples to the energy momentum tensor current. So it's really, It's really like that. And when you hear about holography and gravity, there's no big deal about it. It's just the Gauss's law. Okay, holography is Gauss's law. This is Gauss's law. Okay, but the thing about gravity which distinguishes him from any other force in nature is causality. Okay, time flows only in one direction, which means what? It means that the charge of gravity energy is only positive. There's no notion of negative energy. And because energy is always positive, there's no screening. So if something wiggles in the center of the sun, I feel it. There's no screening. There's no way you can create a Faraday cage of gravitational wave. Gravity is something that transfers the whole universe. Okay, and so when you think about gravity, if you try to think about observable, you really have to think in terms of non-local observables. Another beautiful example of this effect, it becomes very, today there's this big discussion about, what is it, Hawking announcing that he may have resolved the information paradox, but it's based on somehow the what I call non-local memory effect, which is a beautiful effect of gravity, which says that it's another simple example of why gravity is fundamentally non-local. Suppose there is a photon in this room that just, you know, somebody shines a line below and it goes up. Okay, so I have a photon that, let's say, goes up here. Okay, and then I look at two observers. So, you know, this is I have an observer at distance d, and then another observer which is at the same distance here, 1, 2. Okay, and let's say they are, you know, initially their clock is synchronized. Okay, what happens is that before the photon appears, let's say, you know, the photon is there, and the photon is in, you know, Mathilde is between me and the photon. So before the photon is synchronized, we know what is the relative distance between us and what is our clock. After the photon has passed into this room, in fact, if we are fine enough, I will find that, in fact, Mathilde has been, you know, attracted more by the photon than I have. So now we are not exactly at the same height. She got up. And then if we compare our clock, we'll see that the clock of Mathilde is retarded compared to mine. So we are exactly in the same place. And this effect could be felt as far as you want from where the photon is. All that matters is that, you know, there is the same relative distance between her and me than me and the photon there. And this is what, so after the photon has passed, you know, the two observers, one is here and the other one is there. So there's a delta Z here and the clocks are, you know, I'm here, but she's still, or let's say I'm here. But she's here, you know. And then there's a phenomena, which is this memory effect, which is essentially that there's a shift which is proportional to the energy of the photon times the relative distance. So let's say if the distance is doubles of her, this could be a constant factor. So what to remember from this formula is that gravity, what it creates, it introduces a coupling constant, which is G Newton. And the coupling constant G Newton allow me to somehow translate energy into distances. And if I'm able to convert energy into changes of distances, it creates effects which are fundamentally non-local. So this is what's at play there in gravity. It was a long introduction, but I think, you know, for people who are not used to gravity, it's important to appreciate that. So, okay. So, the point of view, you know, I want to take is that if I want to think about gravity, quantum gravity, there's a way to think about quantum gravity that could make you very comfortable if you think in non-commutative geometry, is that if you manage to understand physics from the point of view of theory that has both a fundamental delocalization scale, like the Planck length, and the relativity principle, then it should contain quantum gravity. This is the point of view I'm going to take. The quantum gravity is about delocalizing physics and preserving relativity. Now, here, in order to do that, the challenge of anybody that try to think about replacements of space-time is that you have to give up the whole notion of space-time and replace by something new. So, you know, in non-commutative geometry, you start from axioms that this is a non-commutative algebra, but in physics, I cannot start from an axiom. What I start from is I want to think about geometry as being defined by a collection of probes that interact with each other. So the way we really witness the geometry is not an a priori concept in physics. Geometry is a relative concept. We know about the geometry because I have a little probe that I send, and I look at the world around me, and I look at the correlations among these probes. And from there, I reconstruct the notion of space, time, and geometry. So really, this is the point of view I want to take, that interactions among physical probes are what defines geometry. And I need an organizational principle to really derive what is the proper notion of geometry that explains that. And it's called relative locality. And I'm going to explain a little bit what I mean by that. And relative locality is taken as the organizational feature that allow us to tame non-locality. So in this approach, processes among probes define the localization notion of space-time. What's very important concept here is that you want to have process among probes that preserve quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, there's a very important symmetry of quantum mechanics, which is the possibility to change polarization, possibility to go from position space to momentum space. And somehow this process of localization should incorporate this symmetry that I call bond duality. Anyway, this is the very general motivation. If you try to think about going away from space-time, you have to understand what is the hypothesis that you're questioning here. And the hypothesis that you're questioning is the hypothesis of absolute locality. So this is an hypothesis which is put in physics everywhere today. What is the hypothesis for locality? It's the hypothesis that the concepts of space-time is probe-independent. Space-time is the same for a particle of mass m or mass 2m. Okay, that's what space-time is. That's why it can be as static as a mathematical object. Okay, and relative locality is essentially, questioning that. It's formulating a geometrical description of space-time which explores the idea that space-time is a notion that depends on the quantum number of the probes. For instance, its energy. Okay, and if you think about it, you will see that the usual notion of space-time is adapted to very special probes which are point-like and classical. So now we want to understand what is the proper notion of quantum space-time for quantum and non-local probe. So in order to get an idea, a picture of what really is space-time, let's look at the simplest object. Just look at the whole universe. Okay. Now we have lots of what's called full sky surveys, and I put only four, but we have eight of them on all possible energy scale. And so the universe is supposed to be one object, one space-time. But when we try to observe this universe, what do we see? We don't see one image. What we see is that depending on the type of light I'm using, whether I'm using a microwave light or infrared light or X-ray light, so very low energetic light or very high energetic light, I get different images. Of course, when a physicist looks at these images, he assumes that what he's looking is one object, the universe, that shines in different light. But in fact, we don't know for sure. What you really see is that you see different light, different images at different energy, and you see correlations among energy of the same image. And at the end of the day, you would have to be able to analyze the data and to see to what extent do we know that this is the same object it's reconstructing. To what extent do we know that the energy dependence is not in the space-time itself. So here, it's a big object, so we don't worry too much about that. There's another instance where people can really evaluate that. There's a beautiful images which people have done recently, which is, okay, let's look at how things localize quantum mechanically. Okay, so there are new techniques that allow us now to see what is the geometry of quantum states. Okay, I'm talking about experiments. So what people do is that they take a quantum crystal and they use electron microscope, which is essentially put a little, tip here at every single atom, and then they measure, the current that is there. The current is proportional to the density of electron. So, when they do that, they see the density of electron, and the density of electron is a property of the wave function. So they see how many quantum electrons there is. And there is a control here, which is a voltage control, so they can change the energy. So at the end of the day, you're measuring the density in terms of the energy. And you're asking, okay, what type of crystal is it? Is it a regular crystal, disordered crystal, liquid, solid? And the answer is that, well, it depends. Okay? It's all of these things at the same time. So for instance, if you look at the crystal at low energy, you're seeing a space-time as we see it. Translational invariant, usual space-time, no surprise, no features. If you look at a little bit higher energy, you're going to see an ordered system where the ordering, the electrons, are localized around every atom. So here are no longer any surprises. But if you go higher energy, you're going to see a type of delocalization, a new scale that appear, which is due to Friedel oscillation, which are like oscillations due to the presence of impurity, where a new scale appears which has nothing to do with the scale of interatomic distance. And if you look at it in Fourier space, it will be very clear that the geometry is completely different. And if you go to a very, very high energy, it's completely disordered. So the question of whether, and here I'm not changing the temperature of the system, I'm just changing how I look at it. So the question, what is the geometry of the electron in a crystal? It has no well-defined answer. Is it ordered or disordered? Well, it's completely ill-defined quantum mechanics. The same regions of space, we can have different eigenstates of different energy. It's and it's disordered at given energy and ordered at others. So essentially, the geometry of quantum mechanics is in the beholder eyes. You cannot think quantum mechanics and keep this notion of classical geometry, which is energy independent. Okay, and the analogy I'm going to use here is that space-time is like a quantum crystal. There's a feature that we don't completely know, and the electron is the probe. It's us. It's fundamental particles that moves there, and where they are really depends on their quantum states, on their energy. Okay, so this suggests the first thing is that clearly space-time is not a proper way to think about the geometry of quantum mechanics, but phase space is. Okay. That if you want to discuss quantum geometry, you should first understand what is the geometry of phase space. Of a single probe, of a one particle object.
But why? All particles interacting, surely you shouldn't have a higher dimension
of
phase space.
No, I'm really thinking of the phase space of the particle. So here, space-time is what? The space-time of what? It's the space-time of one particle, right? So when you write a field, you write phi of x. What I'm questioning is, what is this x now I'm replacing, okay? I'm thinking of the space-time of individual probe, and of course, they're going to be interacting in that space. And so, I'm thinking about the backgrounds, the geometrical backgrounds in which these things live, okay? So what is the x of phi of x? Of course, I'm not talking, that's a very important point. I'm not talking about the phase space of the fields, which gravitational field, okay? I'm really talking about the phase space of for one particle it would be xp, okay? That's what I'm talking about. As we see before, the only thing I need to really understand the notion of localization is to draw the preferred diagram, in a thing that contains position and energy. And there I have no confusion about where the electrons are. They are well located in that phase space. Okay, I'm going to skip why it's related to, quantum gravity. You can argue in many ways. Okay, so So the geometry, of space-time is encoded into a Lorentzian metric. And maybe if you make it Riemannian, Riemannian metric. So this is what we usually think geometry is. Now I'm saying, no, that's not the way you should think about geometry. Geometry should be about phase space. So what is the geometry of phase space? And of course, the first thing is that if you want to talk about the geometry of phase space, you need to unify in one geometrical setting energy and position, or energy and time and moment. You need to unify energy and time in the same. In order to do that, you need to have a constant that has the dimension of the ratio of energy over time. And we're going to come back to that. So you need to have something which has the ratio of energy over time, or energy over distance, if you want. And that's, in my case, this would be a Newton's constant. So what is energy over distance? It's called a tension. So if you want to have a theory which unifies phase space, you need to have a fundamental tension. It turns out that both string theory starts from having a fundamental tension, but also gravity, gr, as a fundamental tension, which is the inverse Newton constant. Okay, so once you have a fundamental tension, you can unify the concept of length and geometry. The main point here I want to say is that Up to now, when people think about non-commutative or geometry, they think it's a kind of generalization of Riemannian geometry. And I want to argue in the end that that's not wrong, but that's not the wrong way to really think about non-commutative geometry. It seems to me you're missing the point. If you think like that, you're missing the point. The non-commutative geometry, which is really generalizing, is the geometry I'm going to describe, which I call a Born geometry. It's the geometry of phase space. And if you really want to understand what it means to do non-commutative geometry, you first need to understand what is the phase space geometry. So let's leave the, I'm going to be now in between. Let's leave the usual geometrical realm and let's talk about what is the geometrical data that characterizes phase space geometry. What I'm going to argue is that phase space possess naturally three structure. So classically, what is a phase space? A phase space classically something that possesses a symplectic structure, something that tells me that there are, you know, Darboux coordinate P's and Q that do not commute. And so the symplectic structure is the source for the Poisson bracket, and the Poisson bracket is the source for non-commutativity when I put H bar. But this is at the classical level. So then you can ask, what is the geometry of quantization? Okay, the geometry of quantum mechanics. And we're going to see that geometry of quantum mechanics naturally introduced two more geometrical structure on phase space. One is two metrics. One is the quantum metric, H, and the other one is the locality metric, eta. So what are these metrics? Before I argue how they enter in the geometry of quantum mechanics. The first metric is, let's say, if I'm in Darboux coordinates, this H metric will have the form dP square plus dQ square, okay? Now, essentially, this metric comes from, it's the probability, it descends from the information metric of quantum mechanics, so the probability metric is the probability distance that is natural if you have a Hilbert space structure. The new point of view I'm going to take is that instead of thinking, it goes back to this delocalization here. Instead of thinking of G, the coupling constant of Newton, as a coupling constant, I want to think of it as a conversion factor. As I say, 1 over G is a tension. But now in physics, there's one principle that in some sense we don't understand. And here I'm proposing you one fundamental understanding, which is the equivalence principle. We don't really understand where it comes from or what it truly fundamentally fully means. I'm saying here what it should mean or what it's going to mean for me is the fact that the equivalence principle tells me that this conversion factor between energy and length is completely independent of any form of energy or matter you're using. It's universal in the same way that the speed of light is a universal entity, okay, which is the same for any form of matter. If I take this point of view, I'm saying the universality of G, essentially, which is the equivalence principle, tells me that there's a universal conversion factor between momentum and energy. Now, why don't we see it? Because when we measure distance, we see only, you know, distance in Q space, in position. And the reason we see only that is very simple, is that the claim here is that if you, you know, there's some geometry in momentum space that appears, but the gravitational tension, which is 1 over G, is, if you put the numerical number, it's something which is absolutely huge. It's something which is of the scale 10 to the 17 kilograms per angstrom. So in some sense, if you want to see what is the fabric of space-time, if you want to see what is this nature of quantum geometry in space-time, you would have to put that amount of energy by distance to really rip off, you know, the atomic structure of space-time. And for all practical purpose, when we do an experiment, you know, even if there's a thickness in dP, we don't see it. So it's dQ square plus something which is epsilon, which is very small. Okay. So the usual Riemannian metric appears naturally, you know, as just the leftover of this quantum metric from this perspective. But that's not this. This geometrical structure is well studied in quantum mechanics. It's well recognized. The second one is less recognized. It's the fact that it's not enough to just do fully abstract quantum mechanics, because in abstract quantum mechanics, in some sense, there's no preferred distinction. There's no reason to prefer P or Q. You work with operator algebra, they don't commute, and that's it. You don't need any extra structure. But when we do physics, that's not true. When we do physics, we'd better be not confused about what is x and what is p, right? We cannot confuse position, being local in position, and local in energy. We live, we experience our world in position space. I move in position space. I don't, I mean, motion is supposed to be motion in position space, even if I don't move in energy space. Ultimately, they're going to be related. So I need to have a geometrical structure that tells me what is x, what is p, what is my choice of preferred polarization. And that's encoded into another metric that I call the locality metric here. So this locality metric mathematically is defined to be a metric on phase space, which is of signature, which has as many pluses as minuses, signature dd. And in double coordinate, it looks like that, dp dq, but it's a symmetric product. And now you can think of space-time as being a vector tangent to space-time, displacement within space-time as being displacements in phase space which are null with respect to that metric. And the same thing for momentum space. So this metric is essentially the expression that you have a preconceived, when you have a preconceived understanding of what is x, what is p, what you're secretly postulating is that you have a preferred metric in phase space. Okay, and it, technically it's called a Lagrangian structure to have such an object. And essentially, maybe I'm not going to go there, but in phase space, it's clear that you can see space-time as a Lagrangian submanifold, momentum space as another Lagrangian submanifold, and which one is which. And what you call space-time in phase space is equivalent to a choice of Lagrangian, which is essentially equivalent to a choice of this metric here. Now we can go back to this absolute locality ID, and essentially demanding absolute locality is the same thing as demanding that this locality metric is flat. If this locality metric is flat, there's a preferred way of slicing phase space. And in some sense, you can safely say that localization is independent on the way on energy. Okay, but in general, the geometry of quantum mechanics will be such that eta is going to be a curved object. And in general, the relativity principle says that anytime in physics you see something which is an a priori notion, external background that needs to be, you know, fixed a priori and is independent of dynamics, you need to include it in your dynamics if you really want to understand what's going on. And the usual notion of Riemannian geometry appears when you take this phase space metric, the H metric, you look at the Lagrangian submanifold and you pull back your metric on it. And then you can think of space-time as being that particular object here. I'm just, you know, saying these two things, but just emphasizing somehow the complementarity between quantum mechanics and GR. So from the phase space point of view, there's two metric. Now in quantum mechanics, we can see that the quantum metric, because it's just the probability metric, and the probability metric comes from the linearity of Hilbert space, this metric is always flat in quantum mechanics. Whereas this metric eta is the choice of polarization. Choice of polarization in quantum mechanics doesn't matter, so this metric is arbitrary. In GR, it's completely the opposite. In GR, you need to have a preferred notion of what space-time is, and eta is fixed and it's flat. Whereas, you know, H, or at least its projection, is curved. So of course, it's clear why quantum mechanics and GR are completely impossible to reconcile, because they are telling you that the geometry of phase space from the specific have to have completely absolute opposite attributes. And of course, that gives us two strategies. Either you try to, you know, quantize gravity, which render this metric curve, or you try to, you know, gravitize the quantum, which is going the other way around. How much time do I have?
10.
Okay. So here I'm just want to flash. Maybe you know that, because in fact this is a quantization as viewed by mathematicians, right? So. The structure I just described, which came from this idea of relative locality, it's interesting that, in fact, it appears in exactly the same structure appears exactly when you try to understand what is the geometrical nature of the quantum, but not viewed just as an abstract algebra. You know, when you do physics, it's the quantum in relationship with the notion of classical. Okay? So, which is, you try to understand what is the geometry of quantization. And This bond geometry, this phase space geometry, is essentially the geometry of quantization. So when you talk about quantization, you have to start with a phase space. You give some, you know, seeds for your deformation, which is this symplectic structure. This is the classical data. Now, quantum, and here it's you know, consists in two things. You need to add two additional data in order to define what you mean by quantum. The first data is that you need to have an algebra. Right? So you need to promote your commutative algebra to non-commutative algebra. And formally, you can look at this as this problem as a formal problem of constructing a star product compatible with your seeds. Right? And there's a very beautiful, absolutely remarkable theorem by Fedosov that says that essentially the choice of star product compatible with a symplectic structure is in one-to-one correspondence with the choice of a Lagrangian structure on phase space, the way which is the choice of this metric eta. And the way it goes is that if you have a metric eta, you can construct a unique symplectic connection, and then this unique symplectic connection can be lifted to a unique flat connection on the Weyl algebra, which is the algebra of quantum mechanics. And therefore, you can construct, you can glue together your quantum mechanical patch in a unique manner. Okay, this is an absolutely beautiful result, very geometrical, about what quantum mechanics is about. Essentially, this metric eta parameterizes the choice of operator order ambiguity. Okay, so a Lagrangian structure, this locality metric, characterizes what is the star product, what is the product of your quantum algebra. Now that's not enough. Not only you need to have a quantum algebra to define quantum mechanics, but you need to have a Hilbert space structure. So what is the symmetry of the Hilbert space structure? And this is well understood in the context of geometric quantization, where essentially, you know, if you want to understand the construction of Hilbert space, the best way to understand that is to give, you know, in addition to your symplectic structure, your symplectic manifold a complex structure. So essentially, quantum mechanics contains an I, which square to minus one, and if you have essentially symplectic plus an I, you have quantum mechanics in the sense of Hilbert space. Yes, you need it for coherent states polarization, and essentially you define your Hilbert space as the space of L2 holomorphic L2 sections on your phase space. Okay.
Do you know that physics done with geometric quantization and deformation quantization in this case are the same?
Well, here you see. Well, that's the thing. Here they talk about different things.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why you need two structures. These are two different elements, and no, in fact, it has not been completely fully put in mathematics together. So there's the geometry of Hilbert space that goes one way, and the geometry of Hilbert space is a choice of complex structure. A choice of complex structure is essentially a choice of this metric, the quantum metric. Okay, so I think this is what I was saying earlier, is that some elements were understood, but clearly people focused on one side and the other. You know, this part has received, you know, 100 times more attention than this other part. But of course, if you really want to understand quantum mechanics, and that's going to be my message for non-commutative geometry, in some sense, non-commutative geometry has focused on this part, has completely ignored that other part here. And that's why maybe, you know, this is an important element of, if you want to understand the quantum geometry, is that you need to, you know, understand both. And of course, you know, today, of course, star product and Hilbert space, they don't talk very much to, you know, together, but you know, you can imagine a program where the next step is, of course, to understand, let's say, a C-star algebra as some kind of particular merging of these two structures in some very specific way. Okay, so this is what I just said. Essentially here, H is, you know, the information metric. So, and the remarkable thing is that, you see, if I say that H is the information metric, I'm saying essentially that the metric in space-time, the geometry, is really fundamentally quantum mechanical. This is what I'm claiming here. Okay, I just have to forget fluctuations about dp, and it's the same thing. I don't need a third metric, which is the space-time metric. It's already contained into, you know, these two data. If I know my probability metric, I know my bound rule, and I know my polarization, I'm done. I know space-time. Okay, and eta is the choice of operator ordering. Now, what I want to say before going to non-commutative geometry, I'll say something about non-commutative geometries to talk about an example. So I was saying in the beginning, well, particles are point-like, and notion of point is space-time, so, you know, and geometry is relative. So, okay, so let's take another probe, which is not point-like. And today, the only example I know, but I don't think at the end of the day this is going to be the only example, but today the only example we have of a probe which is non-local and relativistic, it's string. So let's look at the geometry of string. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with string theory, what you hear about it, but usually it's always described in a space-time language. And that's wrong. The main message is that string theory between a quantum non-local probe is not a space-time object and cannot be described or understood in terms of effective theory as it is done today. And this is why, in my view, there's this wealth of complication around string theory, is that the question of what geometry they live in hasn't been properly posed in the beginning. So let's look at what we did is to look at the axiom of string theory is that you should look at a conformal field theory, and then you look at little deformation, and it should stay, you know, a conformal field theory. Okay, that's a very precise statement. The miracle is that such an object, so you have essentially a probe which is a quantum object, and it's conformal, and you demand that you know this conformal property is preserved under deformation. So it's a property of the probe, and what's not clear is why demanding these axioms have anything to do with the notion of geometry, but it turns it does. And what we found is that contrarily to what's, you know, believed, that the geometry, if you look at the geometry of strings or the geometry of conformal deformation around the flat, you find that if you restrict these deformations to be just space-time-like, like in the Polyakov case, you don't explore the sets of all possible conformal deformation. The space is bigger. And if you want to explore the space, the full space of conformal deformation, you need, you know, the string, in fact, lives in, you know, you need to introduce this phase-space geometry. So here, this is another way where the same phase-space geometry appear just from trying to use probes which are non-local and quantum. So the proper formulation of string that we call meta-string is a string which essentially propagates not in space-time, but in phase-space. And in order to write it, you need exactly this bond geometry. So this is a classical description, and then you can go on and look at what is the quantum description. And the main result we have, at least in the context of flat, is that quantum string propagates in non-commutative phase space. Okay, so this is the way non-commutative geometries arise, is that in some sense, if you try to look at the consistent propagation of relativistic non-local objects, you're forced to have this non-commutative picture here. In the case of string, this is the result. And what it leads to is a new concept of space-time. That is, we can also look at what are the effective field of string, and they don't live in the usual space-time, they live in what I call a modular space-time. So let me try to tell you a little bit more what modular space-time is. In very simplistic language, and I'm sure in your, then it's the last bit. I'm sure in your C-star algebra language, it becomes very, you know, natural, but I want to be very pedestrian here. So, you know, as I say, well, instead of thinking of fields as functions of Q, you know, this is the usual concept of locality, I want to think of fields as functions of P and Q. But P and Q are non-commutative. So you cannot have a space-time which is non-commutative or a field defined on space-time which is non-commutative that violates local causality. That is the property that causality tells you that things that can be measured have to commute with each other. So in some sense, you know, the point of view I'm taking is that space-time is by definition the sub-realm of physics which maximizes the sets of possible commuting operation, okay? Which is beautiful, which means that essentially you cannot think of space-time if you don't have non-commutativity in the first place, okay? So if you define things like that, it means that you have to take a non-commutative perspective. So, you know, I'm looking at the space of functions of P and Q. This is a non-commutative algebra. Let's say here, very, you know, taking this flat Heisenberg algebra. Now you can ask, okay, well, clearly, what are functions on space-time? Functions on space-time, from this non-commutative perspective, are going to be functions that do not depend on P. And functions that do not depend on P, classically, are functions that are commutative. It's a sub-commutative algebra. Okay, so the space of field has to be defined in non-commutative as a space of subcommutative algebra. But what's remarkable is that in the classical realm, what defines the commutativity is the Poisson bracket, right? So classically, a function of Q cannot commute with a function of P. It's absolutely impossible. But the remarkable thing is that at the quantum level, there are more things commutative than there are at the classical level. It's very counterintuitive. It's very simple to prove. It's absolutely beautiful. So there are more commutative objects at the quantum level than there is at the classical level. And in fact, this is the reason for these modular observables. An example for these modular observables would be in this simple Heisenberg setting would be, consider, P modulo H. So, you take P modulo H over R. You look at momenta as an angle variable. Okay, and of course this observable, when you say H bar to zero, has no meaning because P modulo zero is nothing. Okay, and then Q modulo R. So Q modulo, an inverse landscape. Now, this is a function of P, of course, and this is a function of Q. Classically, they cannot commute. Quantum mechanically, these are commuting operators. It's very easy to see. It's absolutely trivial to see. I just wrote it here in the most spectacular way so that it looks very like I'm making a drastic statement. But essentially, it's like if I have exponential alpha I of P and exponential I beta of Q, and I commute them, so I put I beta Q exponential I alpha P. Okay, so these guys will be, functions P modulo 2 pi over alpha, right? This function is periodic of period 2 pi over alpha in P, and it's periodic of period 2 pi over beta in Q. Okay? So these are periodic functions. They are like angle variables. They're functions of my angle variables. Of course, I'm going to get a phase between the two, which is exponential 2 pi alpha beta. So if alpha beta is equal to 1 over 2 pi, they commute. Okay, so, but this is an absolute classical impossibility, okay? So such algebra is a commutative algebra that has no possibility of existence in the classical world. In fact, you see that classically, a commutative algebra, you think of it, I'm in phase space, I'm taking a maximally commuting subalgebra. So a maximally commuting subalgebra, usually you think, well, it's a function on P. P is dimension D, okay? Whereas here, my modulo space-time is what? It's a function on SD times SD, right? So for instance, the dimension of modulo space-time is 2D. It's not 4, it's 8, right? So it violates anything we know about classical space. The dimensionality of space-time is twice what I think it would be. And of course, but from quantum mechanics, it's not really surprising. There are many subcommutative algebra which have absolutely no classical analog. That's the message. And this is essentially what a typical quantum space-like look like. In fact, you would have, in a non-commutative algebra, you would have to work very, very, very hard to find one which has the property you would expect of a classical space-time. This is essentially the model. This was first remarked somehow by Aronoff, and this is the reason for, this is the observable that witnessed the algebra of observable, exemplifying this very simple setting. So the main, if you try to picture what is a space-time, I say earlier it's kind of a slice, it depends only on x, but now it becomes a quantum cell, a cell that has thickness in x and p, okay? And then the notion of usual space-time, comes up when you squash, in a squashing limit, if you squeeze the p distance and make the x distance very long, for all practical purposes, it will things look only, depending on x. And effectively, this is this second metric, the eta metric is the one that decides how to squash things. It decides, what is thick and what is thin in this modular space-time. So the beauty I find is that if you were thinking about quantum gravity from a long time, the problem was always to reconcile, how can I reconcile geometry, which is a classical concept, with quantum mechanics, which has nothing to do. And the answer is beautiful in that context, is that geometry is defined by the quantum, okay? It's not that you have to build one against the other. It's that the mere notion of geometry is that it's commutative. Okay, and then maybe I'm going to skip that, but you can define the field theory and ask what are the particles. Maybe the first thing, the only thing I want to say is that these particles are no longer for the particular modular spacetime I was devising, which is this flat Heisenberg spacetime. The particles are no longer point-like, but they have a property of dionic. It means that essentially their momenta is proportional to the distance, which is, you know, exactly the same relation that I was having in this memory effect. But here it's built in the fundamental excitation. So this is what a particle in living in a non-commutative geometry really is experiencing, but where space-time is a commutative subalgebra. And it has an extended notion of Lorentz symmetry. Yes, maybe the main message here is the fact that in what way am I, if I go back to the initial thing, I say the initial description of locality, I say one of the fundamental tenets of physics is Wilson renormalization group, separation of scale. You know, the small is very different from the big, and I can think about small without having to think about big. In this context, this is not possible. Okay, so this is why we haven't been able to face it fully, because if you take for serious non-commutative geometry, or you know, this phase-based geometry, you have to face the fact that there is a mixing between UV physics and infrared physics, and you have to make sense of it. You have, you know, if you're really believing what I just said, or if you believe in non-commutative geometry, you're believing that there's a fundamental relationship between fundamental UV physics and fundamental infrared physics. And that's a big step into the resetting of your picture of the fundamental world. So, you know, effective theory has locality built in. So effective theory is dead as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't survive the unification of gravity and quantum. But new notion of locality, like this modular locality, is appearing to be the right notion. Okay. And I think you know I qualify for this.
One question, if it's going to elicit an answer of under 30 seconds. Very good.
The alpha times beta has to be equal to 1, I think.
It has to be whatever, h bar of 2 pi. Or what? I'm going to be something like that. Yeah, it's anyway, going to be h bar.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's just. What I wrote in the slide was good. It has to be, yeah, I think it's something like that. Alpha beta has to be, yeah.
All right.
Page one. Or, yeah.
Maybe.
Anyway, whatever was in the slide there. But I mean, for you, it's something obvious, right? That somehow they are, you know, because you know that that's what Mathilde was presenting. There are notions of geometry which are way more general. So it's a, but I, you know, it's absolutely obvious that there is this notion of non-commutative, you know, subalgebra for commutative one has more complex geometry or more, you know, deeper geometry than the usual classical one. But I don't think it has been fully, it has not been really yet, you know, harnessed fully.
I guess the purpose of my what's behind my question is I don't quite see why why is that so important to look at that these two ones actually commute?
Well, it's so important to look at because if I think of these functions of P and functions of Q as being a classical function, then you know, if I try to write down a dynamical system, I would need to put on this space of functions fields of P and Q a Poisson bracket, and now the only way I can have a object like that, alpha p and beta q, okay, this object, no matter what I do, is going to be different from zero. There's no way I can make something that depends on position commute with something that depends on momenta. And this is why, in a classical world, there is no possibility of mixing translation or difference in position with energy. But I'm saying in the quantum mechanical setting, there's a new possibility which is very intriguing and appealing, which is that now you can mix, you know, you can get confused about you move a little bit in X, but you can also move in P at the same time. And from a physical point of view, changing X to X plus P is a very radical object, because if I say that I'm local in X, something which is local in P is something completely non-local. So mathematically, it's a triviality. But the consequences of it is absolutely, if you say that this is the way space-time works, you're saying that in space-time or in fundamental physics, it's possible to secretly mix X with P, which means that I'm saying there's a secret.
But still, from a geometrical point of view, that's even more trivial, because it's saying you take a periodic function and you shift it by one period and you get the same thing. That's what this equation is saying.
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so you could say, well, it's a usual, because of Gelfand theorem, any subcommutative algebra is always the, so what you're expressing is that it's going to be true that any subcommutative algebra is always the algebra function on some kind of classical space. Okay? So you're saying, well, that's my classical space, which is fine. This is what I call modular space-time. The thing is that usual space-time has dimension 4. The modular space-time, which comes from the... So if you take a generic commutative subalgebra of the Heisenberg algebra, or whatever is C-star compactification, okay? This algebra, you look at a commutative subalgebra there, and you look at you look at the Gelfand dual, you'll find that the Gelfand dual has double dimension, the manifold you started with, and different topologies. So in some sense, I agree. It's kind of a trivial statement, but it's saying that you're confused whether space-time has dimension 4 or dimension 8, right? If you define space-time as in this sense, then now it doesn't look at all like the classical space-time, okay? So mathematically, this modular property of quantum mechanics is very simple, but it took, to realize its significance, the first one to realize is Aronoff. This is how we discovered the Aronoff-Bohm effect. You would say it is something trivial and not. But as often in physics, there's certain simple mathematical facts that have absolute deep consequences. And here it's just what I said: the fact that quantum mechanics is more commutative than classical mechanics. It's...
Thank you.